I guess we Americans now think of ourselves as a post-racism country. I know the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in the last year or two that is a fact. The issue dealt with voting rights, how voting rights of people of color are no longer imperiled. That doesn't exist. So the courts don't need to protect that anymore because we're way beyond racism. But when you recount the events that are told in this book, The Cadaver King and The Country Dentist, race certainly plays a role in how these criminal cases unfolded in Mississippi. In a moment, we'll get into just how that came into play and how it affected the lives of not only the two men convicted of murders they did not commit, but the people around them as well. We'll be right back. Tucker, let's start with you talking about race. I mean, I don't know if you heard the comments, but I was sort of recanting the U.S. Supreme Court decision that we're a post-racist country, that it doesn't really exist anymore. And I wanted to know your position with the Innocence Project there in Mississippi, what you think about that.
Well, let me just say, first off, I really appreciate your read of the book. It's terrific, and your questions are great. And this is a terrific question, and I think it's one that Riley and I tried to spend some time with. I mean, in Mississippi, we historically have locked up more people per capita than any other state in the union, other than Louisiana. And of course, and we recount a lot of this in the book, Mississippi does not have a particularly good history when it comes to lynching and targeting, particularly people of color, to be locked up either for violent crimes or in the early part of the 20th century for nonviolent crimes, which is essentially sort of a re-enslavement of folks. So on the front end, just like this, our story demonstrates, the people we talk about are much more likely, though not exclusively, but much more likely to be people of color, both victims of and alleged perpetrators of crimes. That's true. I think, though, the other point that we try to raise, particularly towards the end of the book, and a portion that Radley, the non-lawyer of the two of us, wrote and did a much better job than I think I would have done, is that, interestingly, there are aspects of this story where race doesn't play a part at all, or doesn't play a part in the way that a reader might normally think it would, taking place in Mississippi and so forth. And what we mean by that, what we sort of document, we think, is that the criminal justice system has structural issues, and by that I mean they're not necessarily issues that are driven by individuals, and to take your question, they're not necessarily driven by individuals who have a sort of racist agenda. But nonetheless, because of the way that the criminal justice system is structured, the outcomes are racist, unfair, unjust, and they mirror the same kind of outcomes that you see in, as we document in the early part of the 20th century, particularly in Mississippi, where there were all kinds of lynchings going on. In other words, when you look at the Brooks and Brewer cases, when you read those transcripts, there's nothing that will jump out at a reader as obviously racist. No one was using the N-word, for example. No one was, with a couple exceptions, but essentially no one was speaking in a sort of racist commentary about either of the defendants. Both defendants had lawyers, one of whom was African American. There were African Americans on the jury. In other words, everything would strike you as kind of, to borrow your term, George, or the term that you were referring to, as sort of post-racist. That said, the result, what happened to Lavon Brooks and what happened to Kennedy Brewer, was really, in some ways, no different from the kinds of failures of justice that had happened in Mississippi, in the 19th and 20th centuries. And in some ways, worse, because instead of them being hauled out of the jail and strung up from the nearest tree, and all of that happening outside of the courtroom, what happened to Brooks and Brewer happened inside of the courtroom. It happened at the trial court, and it was affirmed by the Mississippi Supreme Court.
Radley, you talk to some people, a lot of people, about race. Their eyes kind of glaze over. They don't want to hear about it until you get into specifics like the story you tell in this. I mean, Mississippi, there's racism there, but they don't exactly haven't cornered the market on it. That could racism exists everywhere. And you look at these two doctors that are profiled in this book. I don't see any racial motives. They were just doing it because it was in their own interest to do it. They were making money off of this and ingratiated themselves with police and prosecutors. And because they gave lawmen what they wanted to get the job done, they were used over and over again. It doesn't not necessarily racial motives, but it had effects the same.
Right. And I think, you know, Tucker referred to the idea of structural or systemic racism. I think there's a big misconception about what we talk about when we use those terms. I think when you say that there's a systemic racism problem or a structural racism problem, people think you're saying everybody in that system is racist. And it's actually the opposite of that. What we're saying is that this is a system that was the death investigation system in Mississippi in particular. It was a system that was built and honed during an era of white supremacy. The whole purpose of the institution of lynching was to kind of preserve the racial order, and as we document in the book pretty extensively, the death investigation system, the coroner system, is a key part of that institution. They helped cover up lynchings. They helped sort of sweep them under the rug. They gave, you know, the sort of legal imprimatur to lynching as a tool of the criminal justice system. And it's that very same coroner system that we then see, used during the civil rights era to sort of paper over the assassinations of civil rights activists. And then we see, you know, in the modern era and during the era of mass incarceration, Hayne and West, I don't think either of them, I mean, West was I don't know, you know, what's in his mind. I'm not going to call him racist. He was known to sort of tell a racist joke or two. Neither of them were sort of, you know, Bull Connor, you know, that they were basically just very, very ambitious, but they were in the system that had been designed with a very specific purpose. One of the cases that we mentioned in the book that I think really illustrates this point is there's a point in Mississippi where it no longer became fashionable to sort of ignore the past. It became fashionable to sort of reconcile with it. And so politicians who were willing to kind of dig up some of these old civil rights era murders and re-prosecute them or some cases prosecute them for the first time, that became sort of the politically expedient thing to do. And, you know, there's a case where Hayne was consulted and basically gave a pretty questionable opinion about a drowning in a civil rights era murder that gave the federal government jurisdiction over the case and allowed them to prosecute this old Klansman who probably did commit these murders and probably committed a lot more and certainly deserved, you know, to die in prison. But again, you know, it was a kind of a sort of karmic justice, I guess. But it was a great illustration of how this system had evolved basically to sort of serve people in power. And, you know, during the civil rights era, that meant, you know, outright racist, but later it meant just serving, you know, prosecutors who were more interested in racking up convictions than necessarily dispensing justice. I think this is it's a good lesson that you know, something can be structurally racist even if all of the people operating with the system aren't. A lot of the investigators, the police, the prosecutors in Mississippi, maybe not some of the prosecutors, but a lot of sheriffs, you know, and police chiefs are black and you know, used Hayne and West. And it had the same kinds of outcomes, even though that certainly probably wasn't their intent.
Well, it sort of goes along with, you know, tough on crime. We Americans like to be tough on crime. Here in Nevada, we're in our election season, and people running for sheriff and DA and judges and governor, and everybody's tough on crime. And you mentioned that in the book about, you know, I don't think anybody ever gets elected to office by saying they're going to be soft on crime or more understanding to criminals. And it's driven incarceration rates, through the roof. You compare our country to almost any other place in the world.
One area you see it really pronounced in Mississippi is that Mississippi, they elect their state Supreme Court justices, like a number of other states. And you see this in the 90s throughout the book. And I think this had a big impact on why Hayne and West were allowed to reign so long there is that a lot of these law and order groups got involved in the Supreme Court elections and really threw a lot of money at any candidate that was willing to sort of question convictions and to actually, you know, possibly throw out a death sentence here and there, you know, for constitutional reasons or for reasons, you know, questions about the convictions. And it sent a message to the other justices on the Supreme Court. We interviewed the Chief Justice of the State Supreme Court, who was on the court throughout the period that we cover in the book. And he, you know, to his credit now, is very regretful of how he voted in those cases. And he talks about how, you know, how the it only took a couple of those law and order campaigns targeting a couple of the justices to kind of change the way they all think about these cases. And that's pretty profound.
Radley, can you tell me about Brewer and Brooks, these two men who were factually innocent? I mean, innocent of the crimes for which they were convicted, how long they served, and how their lives are unfolding now?
Well, I feel like I've been talking a lot. I might let Tucker handle this one. Because
okay,
actually,
sure, Tucker. Sort of
knew,
yeah.
knew them sure. better than I did.
Okay.
Sure. They are both remarkable people. I guess I should say this before we go much further on this question. Unfortunately, LeVon Brooks passed away in February of this year, just before the book came out. He had been out for about 4 or 5 years and was not feeling well and had not been feeling well for some time and was diagnosed with stomach cancer. And he did remarkably well for a period of time, but it sort of gradually caught up with him and he died. But they're both extraordinary individuals, and this is not an uncommon phenomenon amongst exonerated folks. They all, of course, have amazing stories, and many of them are, not all, but many, Brooks and Brewer among them, are remarkably at peace and forgiving. Not all, as I say, but LeVon and Kenny both are. Mr. Brewer got out and went to work, and he's worked ever since. They still live in the same place. Mr. Brooks got out shortly, a couple months after Mr. Brewer did, and he has a very, very large family in Noxubee County, Mississippi, many of whom actually started depending on him for a lot of their food. He was a big hunter and fisher, and so fisherman, and that's what he did really for the period of time that he was out, for the 10 years or so he was out. They were, to answer your question, they were convicted and served just over 30 years between them. Mr. Brewer was convicted and sentenced to death and spent about 5 years on death row before his case was reversed, and he spent the balance of the time waiting for a retrial. Mr. Brooks was convicted and avoided the death penalty and was sentenced to life in prison. But they're both just remarkable people. As I say to folks, you know, it's oftentimes or you run across people, criminal defendants, who end up giving you more than you give them as a lawyer, and that's certainly true of both of them. They are inspirational people. Mr. Brooks and Mr. Brewer have both been up to University of Mississippi to talk to students. Remarkable, given what they've been through.
You know, I guess, you know, I said before, earlier in the program, this could happen to anyone, and maybe that's not true. If you got enough money, you could hire enough lawyers that it wouldn't happen to you. But what happened to Brooks and Brewer? But you make the point in the book, Tucker, that once you're in there, even if evidence surfaces that you're innocent, you are factually innocent of these crimes. And I've covered stories of where that is the case here. Where the prosecutors learn you didn't do it, they still hang on to you. They don't give it up. The system doesn't just open the doors and let you out.
Well, that's right. I think that surprises a lot of people, including law students, that factual innocence on appeal after you've been convicted is not a key to get back into the courthouse. There's a famous U.S. Supreme Court case where the late Antonin Scalia authored an opinion in which he said that a claim of factual innocence, as long as you've had a full and fair trial, is in and of itself meaningless. You can't get back into court on that. It's stunning, really, to a lot of people. What he was saying, of course, was that as long as your trial was constitutionally sufficient, in other words, there wasn't anything that occurred in your case, it was fairly tried, fully tried, the fact that you end up getting convicted, even though you may be factually innocent, does not count as a constitutional violation.
Wow.
You know, I'll add, you know, the Mississippi Supreme Court affirmed both Brooks and Brewer's convictions, and Brewer actually sought a writ of cert from the U.S. Supreme Court and was not granted. And in essence, then, what the courts are saying is that those two gentlemen received a full and fair trial. I think what Radley and I try to do in the book is say, you know, basically, you got to be kidding me. You got to be kidding me.
I would throw in that, and Tucker has made this point in talks that we've given. You know, if you were a judge in Mississippi today and you had a case involving bite mark evidence and you told your clerk to go look up the relevant case law and find me the controlling case law that says whether or not bite mark evidence is admissible in Mississippi, you know what two cases would come up? Brooks and Kennedy Brewer. Even though both men are innocent, because they were sort of exonerated and it wasn't an appeals court that overturned their convictions, to this day, those are the two controlling case laws in Mississippi that determine whether or not bite mark evidence is admissible in court.
I forget what the old truism is. It's better for 100 guilty people to go free than for one innocent man to be sent to prison, or maybe it's one at 10 to 1, something like that. You'd have to guess there are a heck of a lot of innocent people who are behind bars in this country. The John Grisham quote in the beginning of your book, it was 2% to 10%. We don't really know, do we? Or Radley, do we know how many?
We don't. And the best we can do is look at the cases for which we've had DNA exonerations that have shown actual innocence and then try to sort of extrapolate from that pool of cases. But you know, it's important to remember that DNA was DNA testing was a wake-up call, but it wasn't a panacea. I mean, the percentage of cases for which DNA is dispositive of guilt is pretty small. But what we do know from that pool of cases is that there are some very serious flaws in the system. And we know that those, you know, it's common sense to think that those flaws that we found within that small pool of cases exist in the much larger pool of every other case. It's just that we don't have this you know, sort of, overpoweringly convincing method of determining guilt or innocence in those larger cases. And the really scary thing is, you know, going forward, DNA testing will be used in all of the cases in that small pool, right? So, you know, going forward, DNA testing is going to be used before the trial. And so only sort of guilty people are probably going to be convicted in those particular DNA cases. If we don't fix the system, those same problems that, you know, plagued our system before DNA testing are still going to exist outside that small pool of cases. We're just not going to have a tool to find them anymore, and we're not going to get another wake-up call. And so it is really crucial that in this sort of window where you still have public outrage and there is still a willingness to be shocked by the notion that innocent people can be convicted, that we make the right changes and enact the right reforms. And sadly, we really don't appear to be going in that direction.
Well, it's not only they can be convicted, but they can be executed. I mean, I don't know that we can put a number to that, but maybe we can talk about it on the other side after this break, and we'll take some calls from our listeners as well. We'll be right back talking about The Cadaver King and The Country Dentist, this amazing book by Radley Balco and Tucker Carrington. You know, thanks to the popularity of crime shows, we've all become sort of experts on murder and analysis of forensic evidence, you know, not only bite marks, but hair analysis and ballistics and fibers and things of that sort. We all know about how DNA is used, and it has affected trials and prosecutions in pretty overt ways. But is it moving in the right direction? We're talking with my guests, Radley Balco and Tucker Carrington, based on their book, The Cadaver King and the Country Dentist, and where things might be heading. And we open up the phone lines with your calls and questions and comments in just a moment. Tucker Carrington, is there any kind of reasonably accurate numbers on how many people may have been executed for crimes they didn't commit?
Well, they think, I think the guess is a dozen, dozen and a half. There's argument about some of them. I know I teach one, an amazing one of the first out of Nebraska, William Jackson Marion, at the about the 1875 or so. Was hanged in the Indian Territories for allegedly murdering a partner of his. They supposedly found a corpse with a bullet in it. It had some of the same clothes that Marion's friend had been wearing, and Marion was tried and convicted and hung. And about 4 years later, his friend came back from the Indian Territories alive. So we know there've been executions of wrongfully convicted people. I think the most famous sort of contemporary one is the case of Cameron Todd Willingham out of Texas, who was convicted of an arson murder and executed by the state of Texas. And there's consensus among forensic experts who have now sort of revisited arson science, the science that got Willingham convicted, and determined that in all likelihood that fire was accidental. So yes, in answer to your question, I think we most assuredly have. And, you know, exactly how many is up for some debate, but there's no debate that innocent people have been executed.
Radley, I mentioned the CSI effect and the American public's familiarity with forensic analysis and expertise, and what's the expectations of juries are so high. They're all looking for that smashing piece of DNA evidence. You mentioned in the book about how the National Academy of Sciences came out with a report that sort of demolished the legitimacy of bite marks. And since then, bite mark analysis is still used. Other questions have been raised about things that we take for granted, the ballistics of, matching a gun to a bullet, hair and fibers and tire tracks and things of that sort. And then additional questions about things like the legitimacy of the FBI's own lab, as well as other labs. I mean, there are a lot of holes in the system that can lead to problems and problems that are still affecting the outcome of cases, right?
Right. So the NAS report and subsequent forensic reports by the actual scientific community. And it's important to remember that most fields of forensics, with the exception of DNA, evolved not in scientific labs, but usually within police departments and within the criminal justice system. And they were sort of invented and honed over the years to help police and prosecutors solve crimes, not, you know, just in a kind of search for knowledge like other science, you know, is brought to us. Most of them haven't been subjected to the rigors of sort of scientific testing and the scientific method. And when they are, they typically come up short. And so one sort of big area of forensics that's come under a lot of criticism from the scientific community is what they call the pattern matching disciplines. And this includes bite mark evidence. It includes fingerprint matching, actually. It includes tire tread analysis, footprint matching, ballistics matching. And basically, these are fields where, you know, unlike DNA, where basically the analysis consists of a forensic analyst looks at a sample from the crime scene, whether it's a hair fiber, carpet fiber, or tire tracks, or, you know, any kind of evidence from the crime scene. And then they look at another piece of evidence that belongs to the suspect in the case, and they just eyeball it. They just say that looks like a match or that doesn't look like a match. And, you know, in some cases, you know, this isn't completely useless. You know, in some cases, there are distinguishing characteristics, but the problem is it's completely subjective, and there's no margin for error. There's no way you can sort of calculate, how often they're going to get it wrong. in most of these fields, the analysts don't let themselves be subjected to proficiency tests. Most of them aren't double blind. A lot of times they're given way too much information about a case before they do the analysis. No, I mean, ideally, in one of these cases, let's say it's a hair fiber case, you would take a hair from the crime scene and you give it to the analyst, and you would give them also, you know, 8-10 other samples of hair in addition to a hair from the suspect. And, you know, if they can really do what they claim they can do, they should be able to match the hair to the suspect and exclude all the other ones. But that's not usually how it's done. How it's usually done is they're given only the suspect's hair and then the hair from the crime scene, and they're asked, is this a match? And, you know, they're typically told this is the person we think did it. And so all kinds of cognitive bias can creep into that. And, you know, the kind of real hard truth here is that because of the CSI effect that you mentioned, because these shows have conditioned jurors to want certainty, to want that sort of knowledge that, you know, we put the dirt from the bottom of the shoe in our forensics machine and it told us, you know, it could only come from this one county and therefore it could only be this person. Like, they want that kind of certainty. The problem is a conscientious scientific witness, expert witness, doesn't speak in certainties. They speak in probabilities, and they're careful, and they hedge what they say. And jurors actually find them less convincing than a charlatan like Michael West, who will get up and say things like indeed and without a doubt. Jurors crave that. And so the less scientific you are, or I guess the better way to put it is the more scientific you are,
the less certain.
The harder it is to get juries to sort of take you seriously.
Tucker, one more question for you, and then we'll go to the phones. What's the reaction been to the book in Mississippi and in a larger stage? I mean, I would imagine it kind of dropped like a bomb.
Yeah, I think, I don't know that I can answer that question fully. I think Riley and I have received, I'd say mostly positive comments in the vein of, people are glad that at last this story has been told completely. It wasn't a secret. I mean, it was kind of an open and notorious thing that was going on. And so I've been pleased, we've both been pleased that within the state here, people have been glad for the story. There've certainly been folks who would quibble with how we've characterized the blame that should be allotted here and there, but by and large, the book has been, if you can say this about this book, the book has been well received.
Well, good. We got a caller on our first time caller line, Patricia, calling from Mississippi, who may have personal knowledge of some of the characters profiled in the book. Hi, Patricia. Welcome to Coast AM.
Hello. Yeah, in 1991. The actor I was arrested, I think I went to trial in 1992, and Dr. Michael West was one of the expert testimonies at my trial. I happen to be white, and I don't really think it's about a black or white thing. I think if they get somebody, no matter what, they don't even care if they're innocent or not. They're going to convince everybody that there are. It's and people don't know that really happens. Like you said, maybe 2 to 10% of the people that are actually in prison are actually really innocent. I was convicted of manslaughter. And even though I've been out of prison for all this time, I'm still affected by it. I mean, it's just, I can't believe that it can really happen in America. People don't really think things like this happen. And what's really sad is the person that killed my son got to go free. And I really think, I don't know, I think that this person was a serial killer, and that's another whole story, but it's just...
Patricia, you were convicted of killing your son?
Yes.
And Michael West, what testimony did he give that helped convict you?
Okay, he said that I stepped on my son, that there was a shoe mark. Now, this shoe was two sizes too big, winter shoes in the middle of summer that I would wear. And Daryl Hurst, the person I think killed my son, said he saw me wearing these shoes. Now, winter shoes in the middle of summer, I mean, come on. Dr. West said that was the mark on my son's abdomen.
Tucker, I think the point Patricia makes about the shoe, and aren't there other examples in your book? I seem to remember that there are some shoe analysis by Dr. West that you call into question.
I know Patricia's case, and there is a shoe analysis case. In fact, our office, along with some patent lawyers, actually pro bono patent lawyers in Houston, just won a death penalty case. We got a 23-year-old death penalty case reversed, which involved a shoe pattern expert. There's a case currently pending in the U.S. Supreme Court, a death penalty case in Mississippi, also based on pattern matching from shoes. So, as Radley mentioned earlier, it falls into the category of sort of one of these, I don't know what the word is, more popular pattern matching techniques, is matching usually the sole of a known shoe to, usually from a suspect, to a print left at the crime scene. Go ahead.
And in Patricia's case, it's even more absurd because it wasn't a shoe print on the body. It was the bruises on the body from being stepped on that West claimed were a match to this particular shoe. I mean, it's even more absurd.
Right, a bruise pattern matched to the boot.
Wow. Patricia, appreciate you calling in and sharing your story with us. Hope you're hanging in there. And we have links and everything to these gentlemen if you want to get in touch with them and talk about it further. We're going to go east of the Rockies. Nancy in Pensacola, Florida. She's going to ask a question I had in mind about, whether or not people who are wrongly convicted can do anything about it once they get out. Nancy?
Hi. Thank you, gentlemen, for taking my call. I just was wondering if there were any civil suits or remuneration for the prison time for these innocent people. And, Greg, I have a quick question for you. I mean, George.
Yes? Okay. Hello?
Hey.
We can sort of hear you. You want to try that again?
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. I was just wondering if there was any kind of civil suit or monetary remuneration for the time these innocent men have spent in jail. And, George, I had a quick question for you.
Yes, and I asked you, what is it?
Do you have a brother named Greg?
No, I do not. There's an attorney here in Las Vegas named Greg, but he's not my brother. Let me add some context to Nancy's question. You guys do address what happened to the two convicted men in your book in that regard. Here in Nevada, I've covered a couple of stories where it seems like prosecutors will reluctantly let somebody out after they learn they're innocent, so long as the person signs papers that say they're guilty. I guess part of that would be so they can't sue for damages.
Yeah, I'll take, Radley, why don't we split this question? I'll answer the first part, which is after Mr. Brooks and Mr. Brewer were exonerated, the year after, the Mississippi legislature passed compensation legislation unanimously, which allows wrongfully convicted persons to receive compensation in the amount of $50,000 per year for every year they're incarcerated, up to 10 years. It's capped at $500,000. Mr. Brewer and Mr. Brooks each received that compensation. The issue of civil suits is more difficult, and Radley has written a lot about that and can speak to it.
Yeah, so West and Hain, well, first of all, I mean, it's almost impossible to sue a prosecutor. They have what's called absolute immunity, and it's very, very, very rarely successful. Now, Brooks and Brewer did sue Hain and West, and you know, claimed that they had you know, basically manufactured evidence against them. And that suit, about 6 months before the book came out, that suit was thrown out by a federal appellate court, appeals court, who basically ruled that Hain and West had what's called qualified immunity. And qualified immunity, basically, you have to show that that they acted with malice, that they intended to give false testimony. And I actually think there was some evidence of that, particularly with West and manufacturing the video of him manufacturing the bite mark. Unfortunately, the federal appeals court, you know, ruled that while West and Hain may have been grossly negligent, that didn't get quite far enough. Brooks and Brewer had to show that they knew that the evidence they were giving or the testimony they were giving was fraudulent, and really short of a recording of them, you know, saying, "We know what we're about to say is false, and we're going to say it anyway." It's really difficult to get beyond that qualified immunity hurdle. So they'll get nothing from Hain and West, and Hain and West really are not going to be held accountable in any real way. Neither is used by the state anymore as an expert witness, but Hain still testifies. He testifies for defense attorneys now. West has largely been abandoned. I don't think he's testified in court in a long time. However, I will say that the state of Mississippi is still defending convictions won based on West's testimony.
These guys made a lot of money, didn't they?
Well, Dr. Hain certainly did. Dr. West probably, I don't think as much, but he made a reputation.
Let me ask you one. Sorry, we're not going to have time to take any more calls, but I wonder if the book will help law students, will be raised in curriculum in law schools, if nothing else, to teach lawyers, defense lawyers, to be on guard for this kind of stuff, to question this kind of evidence and expertise.
Well, that's one of the hopes, obviously, is to sort of raise the bar and the level of rigor that defense attorneys — we didn't talk much over the course of this interview about defense attorneys, which is okay, but they share in the blame as well. Now, some of it is not their fault. The sort of system is stacked against them and their clients, but to the extent that defense attorneys can make a difference and, as you say, sort of have these issues on their radar, then that's certainly one of the hopes among many others for the book.
Radley Balco, Tucker Carrington, this is a powerful and important book, The Cadaver King and the Country Dentist. I hope people will read it and take it to heart and pay attention to it. And I can't thank you enough for coming on the show.
Well, thank you for having us.
All right. And we've got links to the book. You can learn more about it on our Coast to Coast website. Thanks also to my earlier guest, Jim Goodall, and his excellent work on the SR-71 Blackbird book. And I want to say thanks to my colleagues there at Coast to Coast, Nathan Staton and Donna Walker, our webmaster, Greg Bishop, Lex Lonehood, Dan Galani, producer Chris Boros. And I'm George Knapp. I'll be back soon. Hope you have an enjoyable Memorial Day holiday.